and get started. Amazing how one guy's mistake can lead to such a massive change. There was this guy called Justus von Liebig, who was quite a well-known chemist of his time, who took some plant, burnt the plant matter, analysed the ash with the quite crude technology they had to analyse at that point, and deduced that mostly what was available was nitrogen, phosphorus and potassium, and announced to the world that that was really all we needed to grow a crop, and that maybe we could change the entire way we farmed with a whole range of inactive armaments plants that were available at that point in time that could very easily be adapted to produce ammonium nitrate and a bunch of other salt-based fertilisers. And so he changed the world. The world of industry sprung into action and the wheels of industry began rolling and pumping out these fertilisers, and initially there was quite good responses, and very good responses in some instances. Interestingly, von Liebig actually realised his mistake. He actually later became quite an expert. He's the guy who developed von Liebig's law of the minimum in relation to trace minerals, and he realised that, oh my goodness, these trace minerals are spark plugs, they're triggers, and they're not there, and perhaps I didn't pick up their presence in the small amounts that they're there for, but the amount doesn't govern their importance, and he realised those things, and he tried to publish. The urban legend is that he went to his deathbed saying, why wouldn't they listen? No one would publish. No one was going to derail the gravy train that had become the production of salt-based fertiliser. And so for many years, we didn't even test for trace minerals. Often we tested just for NPK and sometimes sulphur, more recently calcium and magnesium, and the trace minerals were as if they didn't exist. And that's simplistic. I mean, it is so simple and so basic. Every time you take some food off, and that's why it's so silly what they've done in organics in Europe, to have gone from 6% down to 40% now pulling out of organics, simply through not understanding this most basic thing. When you take food off the soil, you're taking minerals away from that equation. And at some point, you've got to put some of them back. And if you don't, you're mining the soil. And that's what we did for decades with the simplistic concept that the first cell of these from the Precambrian ocean had 74 minerals, and nothing happens accidentally in this wonderful blueprint called nature. They all play a role, we just don't know what they do yet, and that's why there's such great benefits in having them all covered with things like sea minerals and ocean-based products and so forth, is the concept. So we didn't... The recognition is that a little bits of everything that you're taking from it. So, for example, I'm on Norfolk Island, this wonderful little island between them, so I've got a farm there. I loved it so much when they brought me over to train their farmers in biological agriculture. And a friend of mine, who's actually the head chief minister of that island, she had this really high blood pressure just a few weeks ago when I'd gone and been doing some of my writing, which I do. And I test her with the device I've got for measuring here. And she's got incredibly low chromium levels, and I discovered on researching chromium, I just finished writing an article about it. The chromium, we measure chromium because we test heavy metals in our course normally, and so we test all minerals and some heavy metals, but chromium's not a heavy metal. So we test chromium. Many people are chromium deficient, and I find that chromium is incredibly strongly linked to every aspect of a condition called metabolic syndrome, which is a precursor to the things that kill us most commonly, heart disease, diabetes, and stroke. And so if you've got three of the five things that are guidelines of metabolic syndrome, you're considered to have it. So we're talking high triglycerides, high LDL cholesterol, gut fat. He says tapping the extra 5 kilos from 9 months on the road, eating out every night. I've got to get rid of it because it's not a good thing to have. The other two things, high blood pressure and high blood sugar, those five things. You've got three of them, you've got metabolic syndrome, and you've got 4, 5, 6 times higher chance of succumbing to those three diseases that kill us most commonly, with cancer in there as well, of course. I got off on that digression really quick. We're talking about blood insulin, we're talking about blood sugar levels, fasting blood sugar levels. Yes, I mean, I know, in my case, this is actually doing a hair test analysis. But the bottom line is that she had no measurable chromium in a hair test, and then I started testing Norfolk Island soils, because who tests chromium in soils? And I've never done it before. And I don't know if it's unique to Norfolk Island, but I discovered that they have really insanely low levels of chromium. In fact, it's barely measurable in most of the soils. And then I'm thinking, my goodness, they have very high levels of all of those things that are associated with metabolic syndrome, and they're quite unique because they only eat their own food, So they really are what they eat because they're not allowed to import food. And so how important is chromium in that equation, I'm wondering. But anyway, we'll keep moving because I'm digressing already and we're in the first slide. This is supposed to be quick. So as we mentioned, you're a chlorophyll manager when you grow food. You are looking after chlorophyll density. You're making sure that you've got the sugar factories to photosynthesize, to feed the microbes, to feed the plant, the microbes feed the minerals back to the plant to create that wonderful food. And you know, if you've got blotches and power colors and structure, you're not a very good chlorophyll manager, and most of those things, or many of those things, are related to trace minerals. So one of the things with trace mineral with trace mineral correction or trace mineral nutrition is that it's very easy if you've got borderline trace minerals, if you don't have good levels of them and you've only got some things that are just enough to get you away with it, when you bring in something to correct it, like you bring in some zinc or some copper, you can induce the deficiency of something else. So one of the tricks that we use is that if you're ever going to do a do-it-yourself zinc with a bit of folic acid or whatever, that you have a background of one of these trace mineral mix. I mean, we have one called Shuttle 7, but you might have anything available here, and you have a small amount of that, half a litre in there with your do-it-yourself cheap way of doing the zinc with a bit of folic acid and zinc sulfate, so that you've got a bit of everything covered and you don't induce a trace mineral a deficiency. And it's very common to see induced deficiencies through trace because of the fact, as we see here, a more advanced version of Mulder's charts. This is antagonism. Everything antagonizes several other things, and if something's minor and you bring something more of it in, suddenly you've antagonized it. So no minerals and iron, they're all incredibly interrelated, and having that background nutrition is one of the tricks you can use to avoid an induced deficiency. The other issue is that micronutrients are not just important for the soil and for plants and animals and humans, they're also important for the microorganisms who are at the base of that entire health equation. They need microorganisms just the same way that plants do. And so we see, for example, that nitrogen fixers can't operate without iron and molybdenum. We see that this free-living nitrogen fixer called azotobacter must have reasonable zinc levels in the soil to do its role well. So we need to be addressing our trace minerals and making sure that systems work. We see that cobalt is mother's milk to nitrogen fixers. We see that soluble silica and calcium aren't just for cell strength. In the plant, we see that we're talking about a single cell creature, 500,000 on a pinhead, 2 tons of this creature in the soil with a single cell. And they need calcium and silica if you're going to have a robust organism that's doing a good job for you in the soil. So it's not just about plants. We see that boron, which can open up the trapdoor that allows the translocation of the sugars produced in the little sugar factories, and if you don't have enough boron, the trapdoor stays closed. Boy, does that cost you? Because you're not feeding the army. And you stop feeding the army, you don't get nitrogen, you don't get phosphate, you don't get potassium, so you don't have disease management, you don't have all the nutrients that the army feeds back to the plants, that all falls in a heap because you didn't do $2 worth of boron. And we understand how dramatically a single trace mineral can impact our entire system. And if we talk about the new research into glyphosate, aside from the horror show human health findings in the last 18 months, we look at the work of Professor Don Hoover, who is one of my heroes, and we see one study alone. We saw no one even knew, to the best of my knowledge, that there were even organisms in the soil called manganese-reducing organisms and iron-reducing organisms, organisms that are responsible for the delivery of manganese and iron. And then Don shows with his research that one of the many side effects of the world's most widely used chemicals is that it kills the organisms that deliver manganese and deliver iron. And you know, interestingly, we now find that iron is the world's largest deficiency, particularly in the third world, which is cereal dependent. And we find that something like chronic fatigue, which has become a plague disease, is very, very strongly linked to manganese deficiency because the energy of the cell, the mitochondria of the cell, is manganese dependent. So there may have been far bigger, wide-reaching effects. I mean, Don showed in one study where just 2.5% of the solution of glyphosate hit the soil, and it took out 80% of the manganese and 60% of the iron. So it's absolutely toxic to those organisms. Understanding that there's a microbe behind every mineral, and it's all about, that's the bridge between the soil and the plant. You bomb that bridge, where are you going to get your nutrition from? You can go and buy it from the shelf, and you can get, no matter how well chelated, you can get about 50% uptake, but plants are 98% bioavailable. That's where we're supposed to get our minerals from. So it's a serious issue when we're seriously affecting the uptake of those minerals with some of these widely used chemicals, and glyphosate is sprayed all over your food crops is one of them. So we're going to start with zinc, and we're going to talk about the role of zinc in animals and plants and in humans. We're going to talk about all the minerals in that context. But zinc is often called the energy micronutrient. Remember we talked about phosphorus as being the energy, because you've got to have phosphorus for ATP. Well, you have to have zinc for phosphorus uptake, because that's the big ratio, the 10-to-1 phosphorus to zinc ratio. Zinc actually triggers phosphorus to do what it needs to do. So without enough zinc, phosphorus doesn't actually make all the ATP that's required. So we often call zinc the energy micronutrient. We see that we're going to focus on one key thing, because you can't possibly, you've had a flood of information today, you can't possibly remember all of this. So we're going to have one thing, and hopefully you remember one thing about each of the 7 or 8 trace minerals we're going to talk about. So we'll talk about the other things zinc does. It's not the one thing yet. So it regulates plant sugar, it transports carbohydrates. It's really important for moisture uptake. They often call zinc the drought mineral, because if you're low on zinc, you won't have good drought resistance. So really important from that perspective. It's important for several key organisms, including, as we mentioned, nitrogen-fixing organisms. But the big one, here's the big one, and it's the reason that a zinc deficiency will be the most costly of any trace mineral deficiency very commonly. And the big one for zinc is that zinc governs the production of a natural hormone called auxins in the plant, and auxins in turn are responsible for leaf size. So a zinc deficiency in citrus is called little leaf disease, and little leaf means exactly what it sounds like. You've got a tiny little solar panel that is not going to give you much production, and that applies to every crop if you're zinc deficient. If you're zinc deficient, you have a smaller than ideal, a smaller than optimum solar panel. It's as simple as that. You don't have the auxins to produce the leaf size you're chasing, and boy, is that going to cost you. You haven't got the solar panel to feed to make the sugars, to feed the microbes, that in turn, in the house that Jack built, in turn, deliver the minerals. You're going to suffer substantially, and so zinc becomes the biggest cost-to-benefit ratio if you're deficient. A simple little seed treatment for a couple of dollars will give you more benefit from that $2 if you're zinc deficient than any other $2 you'll ever spend. That's how important zinc is in the equation. So then we look at one, we'll go back and talk about amounts. The maximum amount you can apply of zinc in one hit, if you're really, really deficient, you want to bring your levels up, is 30 kilograms. Any more than that is too much, and it starts inducing deficiencies. Even if you could theoretically put more on to get the numbers you're chasing, you never put more than 30 kilograms. So 30 kilograms is 12 kilograms, I think. 12 kilograms per hit per acre, which is how many pounds? That's about 30 pounds an acre, roughly, slightly less, as a maximum before you've actually overwhelmed the system and you start tying things up that zinc can tie up. So that's the absolute top end if you were playing the numbers game. Some zinc hints. The desired ratio is 10-to-1 phosphorus to zinc, really important. When you're putting on zinc, the things that it antagonizes in this ongoing play between different minerals, it antagonizes iron, copper, and sulfur. So you want to make sure you've got a bit of iron, copper, and sulfur in the background. Zinc is a treatment, seed treatment, as we said, one of the biggest things, and it's a problem for organic growers because it's one of the few fungicides that they've got, which is copper, and copper can very easily induce a zinc deficiency when copper fungicides are overused. And of course, when copper fungicides are overused, they are really unsustainable, because it's a mineral that builds and builds in your soil. It's like a heavy metal in your soil. It doesn't just flush through, and it becomes toxic to beneficial bacteria and beneficial fungi. It is both a bactericide and a fungicide, and we don't want high levels in our soils building up, as they will do if you're overusing copper fungicides. So really important to understand that, because it's a common thing. Now, if we talk about zinc for animals and humans, we see that it's related to everything to do with the health of the sexual organism, sexual maturity, reproduction, and so forth. And we'll talk about what that means to us specifically shortly. It tends to work in conjunction with vitamin A. It's absolutely critical for your immune system. Zinc seems to accumulate in the thymus gland because it's utilized to make natural killer T cells, which is a hugely important part of your immune system. It's been shown that if you've got just a 10% deficiency of zinc, you're going to have a compromised immune system. And I will tell you that the vast majority of this room will be at least 10% deficient. We test. There's much research about the level of zinc deficiency, the world's largest deficiency, and about 8 out of 10 of us are quite seriously deficient, not just slightly deficient. So most of us are at least 10% down on the zinc that we need. And we'll talk much more depth if we have a chance tomorrow about why that is and how we can address it. But the importance for men specifically, and to a lesser extent women, because zinc's also linked to the health of breast tissue, and is very strongly linked zinc deficiency to a likelihood, increased likelihood of breast cancer. But prostate cancer is the largest killer of men now, and zinc deficiency is just absolutely insanely researched, and no one's been told about it. We're all deficient, we've got this great problem in terms of our prostate and our prostate health. Now, how and why does that work? Quickly, one of the players in prostate cancer is a heavy metal called cadmium. It's a real simple thing. If you want to give a lab rat prostate cancer, you just take 700 grams of lab rat, for example, and there's 200, that's two and a half milligrams, I think, of cadmium as the figure, something like that. And that gives, it's guaranteed. 2 months later, you've got a tumour on the prostate of the lab rat. That's how you do it. It's just the standard recipe. You do this much body work with this much cadmium, and you've got a tumour. So cadmium's a major player. And zinc has quite a role to deal with. Cadmium goes straight to the prostate gland and hangs out in the prostate gland. And if you happen to be one of the 1 in 10 of us who have enough zinc, and some cadmium comes into your environment through smoking cigarette or secondhand smoke or working metalworking or nickel cadmium batteries or a whole variety of other ways that cadmium can enter, including eating shellfish, oysters particularly, then the cadmium can't actually get into the prostate if you filled it up with zinc. Zinc, there's 7 times more zinc in a healthy prostate than an unhealthy one, than an enlarged one or a diseased one. So zinc's the major mineral for prostate health, and if you've got your full complement, cadmium can't actually make its way and deposit itself. If you don't have your full complement, and you've got a bunch of cadmium hanging out, waiting there, ready to start the changes that it hasn't already, that can go on to become cancer cells, then taking zinc displaces that cadmium. So how important is it for us to take some zinc? And when you do take that zinc, you take that zinc last thing before bed. Men and women, zinc last thing before bed. Why? Because the single largest contributing factor to zinc deficiency is our overconsumption of cereal grains. We weren't supposed to have cereal for breakfast, toast, cakes or pikelets or whatever, pancakes for morning tea, and rolls and sandwiches for lunch, and some more cakes for afternoon tea, and pasta for evening meals. We were never, no organism on the planet was ever designed to eat even a vague amount of cereal grains to the scale that we consume cereal grains. And cereal grains, all of them, contain a natural acid called phytic acid, P-H-Y-T-I-C, and phytic acid forms an insoluble zinc phytate that can't be absorbed. So whatever zinc was present in the tomato on your sandwich is not going to be absorbed when it becomes a zinc phytate. And the reason you take it last thing before bed, and it's the only way and the correct way to supplement zinc, is because you're not eating cereals to lock it up, and it can get ingested and absorbed in that 12 hours or that 8 hours or whatever you allow yourself to sleep. So that's the deal with zinc. First is cadmium. The second is even more important and far more part of a player than what the cadmium story is. Cadmium is 18-20% of prostate cancers. The second player is about the balance in your body between estrogen and testosterone. And unfortunately, our testosterone levels decline regularly throughout our lives, so that at 60 we've got about 25% of what we had at 20. And you might say that's part of aging. Is not part of aging, and it's quite a serious issue from our health perspective. And why are we dropping our testosterone? There are several reasons, but one of them, we can't make testosterone without zinc. And our zinc levels get progressively lower unless we're supplementing with zinc. And so the story with both breast cancer and prostate cancer is that estrogen feeds both of those cancers, and quite dramatically in the case of prostate cancer. And so the testosterone-estrogen balance is fairly important. We want to keep testosterone up there, and many times we don't have enough of it. But estrogen's coming in from everywhere. It comes in, you might have seen the article recently for the feminization of the mammal. It's in all the waters from the birth control pill. It's in all of the food in terms of meat that you're eating. It's in the, in Australia there's a huge big publication from the, or promotion from the chicken industry. We no longer use estrogen. No, you don't, but you're cheating, because you found if you give a high dose of a specific antibiotic, the animals, endocrine system goes ballistic, and it produces massive amounts of estrogen and pumps itself up in the 42 days it's required to produce a full-sized chicken in that country. So the pig industry, the pork industry, the cattle industry, the chicken industry, we've got this estrogen flooding into it. And then of course if you're a farmer farming conventionally, the vast majority of your pesticides specifically are endocrine disruptors. They're actually estrogen mimics, and the body treats them as if you had estrogen coming. And so there's a bunch of estrogen that feeds prostate cancer. And then the worst thing, then the worst single causative factor happens. You hit 40, you're eating the same food, you're doing the same exercise you're always doing, and suddenly you start developing this gut fat you never had before. And that adipose tissue is sort of becomes like like an organ unto itself, it actually produces a lot of things that organs do, but nothing good. It's actually like an alien stuff on your front. It actually helps to, it is, and it helps to sustain itself because it actually shuts down some of the things that tell you you've had enough food, so you keep eating to feed it. And it produces these nasty little anti-inflammatory compounds, but most importantly, in relation to prostate health, adipose tissue produces an enzyme, this is fat tissue in your gut. Gut cells produce an enzyme called aromatase. And aromatase takes whatever testosterone you're still producing and converts it to estrogen. And estrogen, of course, feeds prostate cancer. And you will know as you get fatter and fatter, you develop breasts from all that estrogen. Your aromatase from the fat has converted your testosterone to estrogen. And when you get really obese, you've got no sex drive at all. You're impotent because you don't have any testosterone, you have a whole heap of estrogen. So what's zinc got to do with it? Zinc is the most powerful known aromatase inhibitor. So, you know, if you've got a little bit of extra gut like I have at the moment, the most I've had forever probably, one of the things you do to counter it before you get rid of it, and it's a good game, here's the figures on gut fat. You know, I mean, how fat, you can hear all this nutrition information and say, oh, it's all too much for me. Here's one fact for you to take home. Lose your gut fat, lose that bit of a love handles or whatever you want to call it, and you've got a 500% less chance of succumbing to the 10 diseases that kill us most commonly. That's the figures, go and check them. Fivefold less chance. So you increase your chance of surviving the 10 things that kill us. You increase your chances of not becoming a grim statistic 500% just by losing the gut. That's how important the gut is. Right through every stage of everything, that gut fat is a nasty thing that has stuck on the front of you. So there's some little challenge to get rid of it, which I'm on the list of trying to do at the moment, but I'll keep moving. Zinc is an aromatase inhibitor to stop aromatase doing its dirty work in relation to turning your testosterone and estrogen, which feeds both breast and prostate cancer. They're really important. So where are you going to get your zinc from and how much do you take? 30 milligrams really is the ideal amount, in my opinion, on a daily basis, taken last thing at night, taken as an amino chelated zinc you can buy from any chemist shop, cheap, inexpensive supplement, a tremendous benefit to most of us. Where can you get it from naturally? You can get it from beef livers, you can get it from beef generally if they're growing on a soil that contains zinc. You can get it from shellfish, but you've got to watch the mercury and cadmium in the shellfish. You can get it from pumpkin seeds, it's the highest single source of plant available zinc, but you've got to chew those pumpkin seeds. One of the things we'll teach you tomorrow is how to make a green smoothie and put the pumpkin seeds in a green smoothie and let that 2 horsepower blender do that chewing for you to access the goodies in the pumpkin seed. Now, a simple little thing during the summer, if you can access watermelons, is that you find, and this is for men for prostate health, this is the ultimate prostate summer drink. Watermelon with the seeds, put into a blender so that you actually micronize the seeds and you pick up the second highest salt natural source because it's just behind pumpkin seeds and a really good source of magnesium, which is really important, and a bunch of other nutrients in that seed. But the big story is the red color. The red color in the watermelon is lycopene, and there is such good research now on lycopene as being one of the most protective single plant-based compounds for protection of the prostate. So you've got the zinc, you've got the lycopene and a bunch of other things in that seed, and it's a nice drink. I understand you're not juicing, you're putting it in a blender and you're blending all the seeds with the watermelon. You've got a nice red drink that you can pour back at your leisure for tremendous effect for prostate health. Copper. What's its major role if you start talking about copper? Well, we'll start with it instead of going at the end of the presentation. Copper's major role is that copper, it's not just about using copper as a fungicide, it's about having good levels of copper within the plant as the primary thing that the plant uses, to fight fungal disease, to protect itself from fungal disease. So it's not about spraying it with the copper to kill that fungal disease, it's about the plant's immune system and its capacity to fight fungal infection is driven by copper. So that's probably its single most important thing. It's often thought of as the protein nutrient as well. You'll know if you're growing wheat, for example, you need to have copper up there, you won't have that protein percentage in the wheat. It increases the ammonium form of nitrate, the uptake of that, which is perhaps linked to the protein. It's essential for chlorophyll, for sugar synthesis, and for root metabolism. So another important mineral for the roots is copper. Quite important is the stalk strength story, because if your plant is lodging or falling over, there are three things that determine that: copper, silica, or potassium. Sometimes two of them might be involved, but those are the three numbers. It's what perhaps we should have looked at instead of opting for the Green Revolution. The reason we went with the Green Revolution and the transformation of our entire major food that we eat with the new hybridized grains was because too many crops were falling over. There was a reason for that. Instead of trying to solve the problem with science and saying, okay, well, we'll create the smaller, more bunched crop that won't fall over, and that's the new wheat varieties, which happened as part of the Green Revolution, we weren't told a few things. That's a real simple thing to understand about hybridization and how that deal works. Now, we know now you've got a gene pool. You can't make more, you can't make less. You've got what you've got. And nature determined that those genes all do specific jobs, and we determined, we want something different. And so we can't make more genes to create something different. We've got to take them from somewhere to create a different response. So when you move and shuffle the genes around, which incidentally was done by microwaving a wheat and creating some sort of freakish wheats to develop the Green Revolution crops, but the bottom line was you've moved genes around into different positions and something suffers because what they were doing here has not been done anymore. And what they were doing here most commonly with almost every hybridized crop relates to nutrient uptake. We work with the strawberry industry in Holland, and the new hybrids can't uptake manganese. Everyone knows that. You've got to spray manganese until it comes out your ears to compensate for that. What you weren't told with the Green Revolution was that these new hybridized crops can uptake just 50% of the iron that the old original open pollinated crops uptook, 32% of the magnesium, 31% of the calcium, and low 20s for most of the trace minerals. And one of those trace minerals, called cobalt, but we can't even uptake it. And you can put a truckload and you need a cup of cobalt sulfate and the plant can't uptake it. And what does that mean for us? Well, cobalt is a building block for cobalamin. And cobalamin, of course, is vitamin B12. And most of you in this room are vitamin B12 deficiency because of the Green Revolution. And if you go to South Africa, you pay $15, they take you to the chemist and they go joint with an injection of B12 and you go, oh my goodness. That's how I would have felt if I'd had enough cobalt, because B12 is such an energy provider. And you need cobalt to make it. And we don't have cobalt in the main source, which is our cereal grains, anymore because of the Green Revolution. So the message here, if you're growing home food and you can get open pollinated varieties and share the seeds, do it, because that's where the nutrition is. And a lot more than what you'll ever find in any hybridized plant. You can do this home, you can look at the leaf analysis and see for yourself, I've done it. So that's the message. So instead of addressing the copper deficiencies that were most commonly linked to stalk strength and fixing the problem, we said, oh, we'll just use science and change it. We do that all the time. Not necessarily a good thing. So copper, if you overapply it, can have a fungicidal effect on the soil. Water rates, 15 kilograms or more per hectare. 15 pounds per acre, any more than that is counterproductive. Any more than that can create a detrimental effect on both fungi and beneficial fungi and bacteria in your soil. And look at this, when we talk about minerals, the thing to understand about phytonutrients and the medicinal qualities of food, that it all comes back to minerals. Minerals are the building block for everything. Here's a graphic example. Now we're talking about vitamin C and we're talking about carotene. And look what we're looking at here. The relationship between copper and the uptake and the amount per, not the uptake, but the manufacturer really of ascorbic acid and carotene. And we're talking about milligrams per 100 grams and we're saying no copper treatment, 29, 4, 10 pounds per acre, 45, there's a 30% increase in both. 100 pounds per acre, which is pretty expensive and obviously not worth the effort. 46, 100 pounds per acre is way too much and you start killing things. So you could have actually got that gain by putting an extra 5 pounds in there. But the bottom line is, copper is a building block for these two things and several other things, as minerals are. Minerals are the story. That's how we need the mineralization and so forth. And the trace minerals, that's how we get the medicinal qualities in our food. So, some of the rules of thumb with copper, don't ever put more than the 15 pounds an acre. It can build up and stays there like a heavy metal and become quite toxic. If you have got high levels, high levels of humic acid, we'll talk about that technique tomorrow, can neutralise it. It ties up phosphorus, iron and zinc in your soil, so you can have good levels of phosphorus and good levels of zinc, but high levels of copper, and you'll never have the phosphorus and zinc that you're chasing in the plant. So you've got to foliar spray it, and that's a real nuisance. And you created that by overdoing copper in your soil. We see it with citrus growers, they use so much copper, the conventional and the organic guys, that they'll have 20, 30, 50, 100 parts per million of copper. And every leaf test comes back phosphorus deficient and zinc deficient. and they can't get through it unless they follow this brain. Because if you put it on the saw, the copper just ties it up. So understand, you can make a rod for your own back if you don't understand the problems of overusing copper fungicides. This is an example of just a really well uptaken form of copper that we've invented. But the bottom line here is that it's just demonstrating, this is published research in Spain, that they tried it against copper hydroxide and copper oxychloride, just getting small amounts into the plant very efficiently, and it did exactly the same job. So that's just highlighting, you want the plant to put copper in the plant without putting huge amounts on the leaf and saturating the soil, and you can do that with good collated forms of copper. For animals and humans, absolutely critical for iron transportation. It's an antioxidant, it's part of the superoxide. I won't go into the whole details of the whole enzyme system and copper dependent. It's critical for the formation of the myelin sheath, which is a protective sheath around nerve cells. It's linked to the production of several fairly important enzymes, catalase and tyrosinate. Linked to grey hair. Now, this is an interesting story, but an incredibly embarrassing one. I was interviewing in my first book, I interviewed Joel Wallach, who's sort of a bit of a vet come human nutrition specialist. And Joel said, that grey hair of yours, that's a copper deficiency. And I said, I'll check that when I get back and see if you're lying or not. And so I did. I had an analysis and found out that I was quite copper deficient. So I thought, well, I'll go to the health food shops and so forth and get some copper. No one had any back then. This is a few years back. You couldn't buy copper by itself. And then you got very small amounts in some of the mineral supplements. So I researched and you needed 3 milligrams a day. So I thought, well, I've got some copper sulfate out of the shed. And I realised that it was, I went online in Bluestone, you can use it, and it's 3 milligrams. I went out to the shed and I grabbed my sack of copper sulfate and I thought, well, 5 mils in a teaspoon, so a little more than half a teaspoon would be fine. So I took that, put it inside some capsules, looked at these two blue stalks and thought, gee, this looks like a lot. You know, you get a little bit of copper, 1 milligram, never turns it blue, but I thought, true, that's right. Swallowed it. Anyone know what I did wrong? Yes, you got it. And only one of you, and many people don't, so I'm not as stupid as I sounded. I made a terrible, terrible mistake, and I knew about that mistake. About 1 minute after swallowing those capsules, I started screaming in agony. What I'd taken was 1,000 times more copper. In fact, it's a lethal dose, 3 to 5 milligrams lethal dose of copper. So they rushed me down to the hospital. They're pumping my gut. They said, what do you do? I said, I'm a nutrition consultant, and they laughed until they died. They knew you were a bunch of wankers, now we know for sure. So, that was my mistake. I took 3 grams instead of 3 milligrams, and that was a silly thing to do. So I never found out, because I pumped my gut before I found out it had changed my hair colour. I never had the guts to find out. So the dose for humans is 2 to 4 milligrams per day per person, which is 3 milligrams is the average. Where do you get it from? If you can find a healthy liver, which of course it might be from a feedlot animal, because they discard about 93% of the livers in the feedlots in Australia because they're rotten by the time they've gone through the feedlotting process. But if you can find a clean liver, and it means it has to be organic because, the liver's got to handle the crap. I mean, even wormicides, of course, go through the liver and they're going to be present even in a grass-fed animal that's not organic. So you do have to find an organic liver. But liver is a tremendous food. It really is a medicinal food. And a lot of people with cancer put it in their smoothies raw for God's sake. But you'll do it, I suppose, if you have cancer. But it's the highest source of copper, it's the highest source of iron, it's the highest source of zinc, it's the highest source of B vitamins of any food. It is a tremendous, tremendous food, but you've got to find a clean one, which is not that easy. Legumes, mushrooms, all rich in copper. Manganese, we often call it yes?
You didn't tell us what the number one thing to remember about copper
was. Oh, so the number one thing was the whole fact that it's the inherent, just having copper in your plant, not on your plant, as a fungicide is the key to fungal protection. Manganese, the element of life, they often call it, really important for triggering optimum seed germination and giving that plant a kickstart. Any seed treatment, you're making one up yourself, needs to include manganese sulfate because manganese is such a player in that whole role. There are a bunch of things that impact manganese in the soil. If it's low pH in your soil, you can have a problem with manganese toxicity. If you've got high iron or phosphorus, it's very common that either of those two can tie up manganese in your soil. And if your base saturation, remember we need 3 to 5% potassium and less than 1.5% sodium, you add them together, if you've got high potassium and or high sodium, but you add them together, it comes to more than 10%, you know, do leftists for yourself to confirm it, but most times that induces a serious manganese deficiency for some reason. So hypotassium and sodium, on base saturation, more than 10%, you're going to have a manganese problem in the leaf. So we don't do the whole thing of putting large amounts through and so forth. We'll put a little bit in through fertigation and we'll put some through the leaf and we'll do leaf analysis to make sure it's a problem. But look at the, I'll show you a study of manganese in a moment in terms of animal reproduction. But when we talk about what manganese does in humans and animals, in humans particularly, we find that it's a key mineral in the mitochondria. So energy production very strongly linked to having enough manganese. So chronic fatigue often linked to manganese deficiency. We see that superoxide dismutase is a manganese version of that. There's two or three versions of it, one of them driven by manganese, which is a really powerful free radical in the natural inflammatory in the body. It's an enzyme system that's really potent. You need manganese, and understand that we're probably not getting manganese when we're spraying manganese. What the biggest finding that actually led Don Hoover to his studies on glyphosate was you spray the soybean, the GM soybean, the Roundup Ready soybean, and it's got yellow blotches all over it called yellow flesh, and when you analyze, you find that it has no manganese, and then of course he found it was because you killed the organisms that deliver manganese. And so our food contains less manganese, and look at the roles of it, cartilage formation. Neurotransmitter synthesis. I mean, one in four people over 65 now succumb to Alzheimer's. One in four over 65, that's a plague disease. Everyone with Alzheimer's there's this link, this universal link in the client production of acetylcholine. Well, we can't make acetylcholine without manganese, and all of our food now contains something that shuts down delivery of manganese in the form of glyphosate, so not a good story. Where do you get it from? Nuts, whole grains, black tea is rich in manganese. And deficiencies can very commonly be linked to poor reproductive performance in both humans and in animals. We see, for example, this little study here where we're looking at the hair content of dairy cows and the fertility of those cows based upon the manganese content of their hair. And we see that less than 10 is obviously out of the range that we're looking for. And we're getting 103 successful insemination. We get number of cows 53. And then we get into the zone, the just right effect, 10 to 20 pounds per million. And we've got this increase almost treble in both. Okay, and then we go too much, and we're back to where we start again. That's how nutrition works. There's an ideal amount of everything, in plants and humans and livestock. And this is the ideal amount, in this instance, of the manganese present in that cow. Iron, essential for, of course, you get this overall paleo effect rather than this intervenal chlorosis when you've got an iron deficiency. Really important for chlorophyll density. But one of the things we find, if you've got enough sulfur, if you've got your 30 parts per million of sulfur on your soil test, it's very rare, even in cold conditions, to ever see an iron deficiency. Don't know why, but that's what happens. We've seen thousands of tests over quite a few years. Enough sulfur, you'll have enough iron. It's the most abundant mineral on the planet and in the entire universe, but not always planet available. You don't need more iron most times. Humic acid triggers the release and increases the solubility of iron, and that's what you'd normally use in that scenario. When we look at iron and its role, we find it's used by the liver and the immune system, involved in DNA synthesis, it's found in many enzymes, many proteins. Best sources, beef liver, tuna. The problem with tuna is that it accumulates mercury. And in our country, we've been told you can't eat tuna anymore. And we've even got dirty waters even. Tuna has got too much mercury. It is really, really quite strong. And mercury, there's no known safe dose of the most toxic substance that I'm known to mankind, which of course is mercury. So molybdenum, we've touched upon it, how important it is. Two things. Who's going to tell me the two things that it does? Anyone got a volunteer? Nitrogen fixation. You can't fix nitrogen without it. You can't make the enzyme that fixes nitrogen without molybdenum. What's number two? The nitrate reductase enzyme, you can't convert nitrates to protein, so you're going to eat a bunch of carcinogenic nitrates because you didn't have enough molybdenum to convert it to protein. And your livestock are going to do the same thing. How important is that little trace mineral? Hugely. And look at this. Don't ever think the trace minerals can't be hugely important in your yield and your profitability. This is a famous New Zealand molybdenum study conducted by the Ag Department in New Zealand. And look at this, this is lucerne, which is alfalfa, and rape. It's on two different soil types, and they used one cup of sodium molybdate combined with their superphosphate fertilizer, and that was the yield increases. The lowest increase was 38%, the highest was 603%. Why? Because in those nice New Zealand volcanic soils, everything else was right except access to the free gift. And you give that, and look what you make, because you couldn't, you can't really relate to anything other than nitrogen, because only nitrogen can give that kind of yield increase. But having access to that nitrogen certainly had a massive impact on yield and profitability in those crops. So really important to understand that. Yes.
So is there you put too much molybdenum, what's the sign that you...
Too much molybdenum, and it's only small amounts that are required, is really, really toxic. It's incredibly toxic. And we're talking about, you put usually a kilo per hectare, maximum kilo per acre. If you put 20 kilos of molybdenum in that, you wouldn't be able to grow anything in that soil for quite some time to come. So
it's about a pound.
Everything you can overdo, molybdenum included.
So how pound, kilo per pound?
Yeah, and you can do it just with small amounts through the leaf if you just want a single season response, so the plant's got enough. You can do 100 grams. But the normal amount is a kilo to 2 kilos maximum per acre, which is about a kilo per acre, or 2 pounds per acre is a maximum of sodium molybdate. And everything, no matter what you're talking about, you can put too much on it and a problem, but molybdenum is really toxic, as is boron if you do too much. It's all about the just right effect with all of these things. So what it does in human health, we'll quickly cover. And it is also involved in whether or not nitrates in our diet convert through to nitrosamines in our bowel, which is so closely linked to bowel cancer, and if you've got molybdenum in significant amounts, that won't happen. So if you are, for example, addicted to eating charbroiled steaks, and why the hell would you be? I can't see why people like charbroiled, but people eat it. And if you're going to do that, you know that once you've charred it, you've created a nitrate, which is going to be not good for you. Well, eat some squash or carrots or beans, all of which you can't grow without adding molybdenum. You might not know that, you get a hell of a bigger response because they're really molybdenum dependent crops. So have some of those as your vegetables with your charbroiled steak to at least allow you to get away with it. Or barbecue some lamb, which is the highest meat source of molybdenum for some strange reason. So that's one way you can have your cake and eat it too if you're that addicted to char grill. Yes?
Three very short questions. You said pumpkin seed was very rich in zinc, was it?
Yes.
And then you said watermelon seed also has quite a bit.
Yes.
How about the other squashes?
Yes, all of them have got good levels of zinc. Pumpkin highest, but the others equivalent to watermelon, which is just behind pumpkin seed, so they're all very good.
A Guatemalan friend said that on his farm, when he grew up in Guatemala, they used to feed the flesh of the squash to the animals, and the seeds were ground up, were dried, and roasted and ground up into flour,
yes.
And then that flour was added to food.
Iodine tends to concentrate on the thyroid. Look, thyroid health is a huge story, and thyroid. Unhealthy thyroids are part and parcel of the Western world as we speak, and the thyroid is the master of your entire endocrine system, and it's fairly important to keep it up for health. So when we talk about thyroid enzymes, we talk about, there's several of them, but we talk about, for example, T3 and T4. Well, T3 means 3 molecules of iodine, T4 means 4 molecules. Iodine's a huge player in that equation, a huge player in our health, because we made a few mistakes in some of the things that we did. And for example, there were a couple of researchers, another mistake by researchers, where they actually used radioactively tagged iodine, and they showed that if there was too much iodine in your diet, you could create overactive thyroid, and so we created this thing called iodophobia, and we took out iodine from so many things. The biggest single mistake was to take iodine out of the softening agent for all loaves of bread that we had. It was a major source of iodine for people, because most of us are deficient. Everyone we test almost is iodine deficient. And instead of using iodine, we use bromide. Now, you need to understand that iodine is part of a group of minerals in the atomic table called halogens, and all the other things that are halogens impact iodine uptake. And what are they? Bromide, fluoride, chloride. So every drinking water you drink, the fluoride and chlorine is shutting down your uptake of iodine. Every time you swim in a swimming pool or hop in a spa, it's shutting down. You say, well, I'll take that. I understand that's a problem with all that chlorine in the spa water. So they change it for bromide, and bromide does it worst. And so we changed iodine in their bread softening agent, put bromide in there, and all eating all this ridiculous amount of bread and shutting down iodine, and most people are iodine deficient. So tremendous levels in cannabis were just tested this week, because they don't eat seafood, they don't eat any fish there, they don't land up and they're not eating fish, and that's the ocean things. Kelp and fish are the highest source, of course, abiding. So the great thing if you've got chickens at home is that the chicken takes whatever you feed it and pumps it into its little nutrient capsule called an egg. And the trick if you've got chickens at home, you buy some flaxseed, which is 57% omega-3, and most of us need to boost our omega-3 levels desperately. And so the chicken takes that flaxseed and takes that omega-3 and pumps it into its egg. Really good levels of omega-3. And you buy some kelp, just dried kelp. You can buy in bags that you feed to your livestock, and you feed a few handfuls to the chickens. It's the highest known source of iodine. They pump that iodine into the egg, and you've got a little medicinal egg that you're eating for two things that most of us need. So it's a really important thing to consider. So I think that might be, that's just talking about iodine and the hatchability and incubation of hen's eggs, and we see the iodine deficient, massive difference. It's 65 versus 16 in terms of dead embryos, for example. Iodine really important for a lot of things, including a lot of things relative to reproduction. Cobalt, we talked about it. We talked about the green revolution creating cobalt deficiencies. And we'll just finish off with selenium because they're waiting to start dinner. Massively important trace mineral that many, many people are deficient in. Your liver is arguably your most important organ, probably on par, if not slightly more important than your heart. Why? Because we live in a fairly toxic kind of weird world. There's 74,000 registered chemicals, and the liver's got to handle the junk. And it's a really important detoxification role that the liver plays, and it gets pretty hardly worked. And so the most important single mineral for liver health is selenium. It is so important, and so many people are deficient. Now, we're worse than you guys because we have the lowest, along with South Africa, or the African continent, the lowest levels of selenium in the world, in Australia, New Zealand, and Africa. But in Canada, most people with selenium deficiency, even with your test, selenium deficiency is running rampant. The highest source of selenium, if you want to address it naturally, is Brazil nuts. They have 25 micrograms on each nut. You ideally need 200 micrograms, so you actually need 8 Brazil nuts, and you've got to make sure you chew them, or it just comes out in your poo and you get maybe a quarter of the selenium component. So the trick with Brazil nuts, you're building into your green smoothie. We're going to talk about the most incredible green smoothie ever tomorrow and how you make them. But Brazil nuts is going to be one of those components of many amazing things that you're going to put into that wonderful wellness tool called a green smoothie. And on that note, I think we'd better wrap it up for the night. One more thing. We do need to know that selenium is also linked to plant health. And why wouldn't it be? There's nothing that affects human health that doesn't affect plants. And it took us a lot of years to realise this in relation to plants until the finish. Recently published a paper where they found that with the addition of just 250 parts per million of selenium into a potato crop, they increased the mean weight of the potatoes by 30%. How did that work? Well, they tracked it back to see what on earth was happening, and they said it was a reduction of photo-oxidative stress. Well, what's that, you might say? What the hell's photo-oxidative stress? Well, here's how it works. Have you ever wondered how a plant sits there from 5 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock at night and doesn't suffer UV radiation that every other creature on the planet, every other living creature? Dog can't stand in the sun all day. Cows can't stand there without shade. Humans can't stand in sunlight without getting UV damage. How the hell does a plant do it? One of the ways that it does it is that it produces pigments. And the colours are antioxidants. And the more intense the colour, the stronger the pigment, the stronger the antioxidant factor. And one of the things we'll talk about in human health is what I call defensive eating. Every meal becomes a rainbow. Why? Because all of those pigments, the reds, the purples, the yellows, the greens, all of them are different antioxidants, and the more intense the flavor, and the more of them you've got on your plate, the more protected you are. But for the plant, we find that selenium works pretty much the same way. Plants have glutathione peroxidase. Glutathione peroxidase, this is amazing, the most powerful protective enzyme system in the human body is glutathione peroxidase, made from three amino acids called glutathione and selenium. If you haven't got selenium, you can't make it, you haven't got the protection. And it turns out plants have glutathione peroxidase, and reduced photo-oxidative stress is that without having to frantically do whatever else you had to do to fight it off, if you had the selenium, you could take that extra energy and put it into yield. So plants need selenium just like we do. And on that note, we're going to have one of these nice meals. Thank you.